Hi, everyone. Okay, so since there are a lot of young people here, I want to tell you something about what usually in papers is under chapter motivation, but I call it heuristic to underline that it's kind of fuzzy reasoning. It's like 1492, you decide to sail west to discover India. Okay, so the heuristic was that cuprates are strange, they are exceptional in that high TC can be as high as 165 Kelvin under pressure. And you would imagine that there must be something strange in their superconducting and normal state properties. And indeed, many strange features have been discovered over the course of three decades, some of which are listed here. But the problem is that you can find these same features in quite a few other complex oxides. And actually, in some, you can find all of them. So what I'm trying to say is that while any of these could be a necessary condition, it clearly is not sufficient. Actually, even the sum total of all of them is not sufficient. So I would say my first heuristic thing was that I was trying to identify something which is really extraordinary and specific to cuprates in either superconducting state or normal state or both. And then the other heuristic is that that's not sufficient. These strange features should be universal to cuprates. And that means two things to me. One is that it should be true for every of the cuprates that show high temperature superconductivity. So if you see something in lanthanum bismuth cuprate, but you don't see it one YBCO, that's not what I'm looking for. The other and less trivial part of the heuristic that I was actually largely looking for something that is universal across the whole phase diagram. There are many of these interesting exotic features that are seen in small part of the phase diagram. And I would argue, you know, since you know we have superconductivity from here to here, then that's probably not what I'm looking for. I'm looking for something that is strange everywhere here. And that's heuristics. It is theoretically possible that the nature of superconductivity here is completely different from superconductivity here. And actually, many people in the field felt that way. So there has been a 30 years long debate about underdoped side. But if you look at this corner here, then I would say 9 out of 10 people would have said to you even a year ago that the superconductivity here is of the more or less standard BCS type, while the normal state is Fermi liquid. If that is the case, then I have some strategy. I can start from this fixed point, which we presumably understand very well, and then move adiabatically towards the optimum doping and measure anything and everything that is relevant, physical properties of the normal and superconducting state that are most relevant, which are those that actually relate to conductivity one way or another. And then two things could happen. One thing is that everything flows smoothly and adiabatically from here to here, in which case I would guess or conclude that the nature of the superconducting state here is pretty much the same as here. So it's BCS in some broad and vague sense, at least in qualitative features. The other possibility is that somewhere here I will hit some break and singularity, like a first order thing, and then all the bets are off, and here it can be onions or RVB or whatever. Well, this was conceptually very simple. Realization actually turned out to be quite difficult. My original proposal to DOE was for 3 years. It took about 12. And that's because there was no technique or technology available, commercially available, that we could use. So the first thing is, what does it mean tuning the doping adiabatically? That means a lot of samples, and it also means that you need a very exquisite control of the stoichiometry. So you have to be able to vary stoichiometry in very fine steps and actually measure that. And this is our tool with which we do that. I will not dwell too much about that. That's oxide molecular MBE system, where we deposit complex oxide one atomic layer at a time. That was the synthesis part. There was also necessary development on the measurement technique. One of the quantities that I was interested in is the magnetic penetration depth. It gives you the length scale over which the magnetic field penetrates into superconductor. And it turned out that there were no techniques that will give me the accuracy I wanted. I put my target arbitrarily at 1% accuracy for the absolute value. And strangely enough, perhaps there were no techniques that would come within order of magnitude of that. So we were pushing also this technique over many years. This is probably version 12 of our apparatus. And all I want to say here, that this shows how it works today. These two curves, what we are measuring is mutual inductance. So there is a drive coil that has AC, generates AC field, which you pick up with another coil. You put your film in between them. When the film is in normal state, the magnetic field just goes through. When it goes to Meissner state, it expels the magnetic field, and you see this drop in the real part. So this is the Meissner effect that you see here. There is also, this is a phase sensitive measurement, so there is an imaginary part that actually is also very telling. The sharpness of this peak tells you how homogeneous your TC is. So what you see here are two curves. A red one was the original measurement, and the black one is the measurement on the same sample after about a year. So the sample was taken out, was sitting on a shelf, and measured after a year, and comes to 0.1%. So we have solved this reproducibility thing. And then the absolute accuracy actually depends on how accurately you know the thickness of your superconducting layer. And that's something that, again, took a number of years to find the recipe how to solve this problem. In principle, my synthesis is digital, which means that I'm depositing one atomic layer at a time, and I can count the number of layers. These are the Reed oscillations, so you can count the number of layers you have put, and then you can measure by X-ray diffraction the lattice constant, so I'll get you the thickness of my film to very high accuracy. The problem is that while that I know the film thickness, it doesn't necessarily coincide with the thickness of the superconducting layer. Purely material science or technological problem, we typically get a dead layer on the surface and dead layer between the superconductor and interface. And to solve that, we then protect the superconducting layer on both sides with something that is compatible in terms of crystallography and chemically and electronically. And the best thing that you can do here is you just put this heavily overdoped lanthanum strontium cuprate, which is metallic and non-superconducting, and it does the job. But it solves one problem, it introduces another one. It's a recursive life of experimental physicists. So now we have this problem that there is a mismatch of chemical potential between this guy and this guy here, and that creates some accumulation and depletion layers, and these layers, transition layers, actually can be superconducting. And that means that, again, you have some, and we don't know their thickness and their TC or their superfluid density. In order to alleviate this problem, this is what gallium arsenide people do, is you do what's called graded doping. So instead of jumping from 0.4 to 0.25, I go to several steps. This is schematics, but you get the idea. That minimizes this mismatch of the chemical potentials, but you still can have some residual superconductivity as indicated by colors here. And then this is the ultimate trick that actually does the job. We now dope these two layers with zinc. Very small doping, 0.03% doping, but zinc is a very effective poison for high temperature superconductivity, so it actually kills superconductivity completely in these layers, which we know. And that's the recipe that now gives you the layer that you know exactly the thickness of the superconducting layer. And it sounds simple, but it actually took some years to find the recipe. You can see that you need to do delta doping. So you need really atomic layer control of composition and stoichiometry. And that solves the problem. So this project to get to the goal took a lot of technical advances in the hardware for the synthesis, but also in the synthesis recipe, so improvement on the synthesis sample side. It also required a lot of improvements in the metrology, if you wish, the measurement techniques in both accuracy, which I advertise a little bit, but also in expanding the temperature range at which we measure, the frequency range, the magnetic fields. We also use some combinatorial technique to actually tweak the composition in steps of 1% of 1%, two orders of magnitude better than with conventional techniques. And the last but not least, this experiment took about 12 years, and in course of that we have synthesized more than 2,000 platinum strontium cuprate films and studied them in detail, so it's an enormous database of, let's say, 50,000 files. Why is that important? If you want to study cancer and you go to NIH and say, I develop a cure for cancer, and they ask you how many patients did you test it, and you say three, okay, they'll say, go check your head. If you're dealing with complex system where there are many parameters that can dance on you, then you need a lot of statistics to average over irrelevant and find what is systematic and what's intrinsic. Okay, so we can now move to the results. First, for the penetration depth. Okay, this is a measurement of on one film, optimally doped. This is your Meissner. This is the dissipative peak. Here is the same peak magnified, so you can see how sharp it is. And the upshot of that is that what this tells you, that TC is uniform in this film, which is 100 millimeters square on the scale of 0.1 Kelvin, and that's 10 microelectron volts. So the superconducting gap is uniform to 10 microelectron volts, which rules out some possible scenarios. Now this is the raw data for penetration depth. Basically, I'll be showing you only the raw data, and the conclusions I want to derive follow from the raw data without any assumptions. These are the raw data. So this is lambda penetration depth as a function of temperature for optimum doping. And then as we move this way, we are changing the doping. I'm showing 100 films here, which are the best with the sharpest transitions. And what's obvious without any analysis is that you see that this is evolving smoothly. These curves are more or less parallel to one another, so there are no jumps. To contrast this in peptides, there is a known case where there is a quantum critical point, and then at that quantum critical point, lambda diverges. It goes to infinity and it comes back. You don't see anything like that here. More informative is if you just report the same data, basically as 1 over lambda square, up to some constant which is not sample dependent. That's a quantity that is technically known as superfluid stiffness. Vaguely, intuitively, it's some sort of a temperature characteristic temperature at which the fluctuations of the superconducting phase destroy superconductivity. And you can take home three messages from this plot. The first one, that this superfluid density actually is essentially linear function of temperature from zero, to be precise, 0.3 Kelvin, all the way to TC. The second is that as you increase the doping, that superfluid carry density actually goes down, 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 down to zero, while your carrier density is going up, up, up. Okay, so there is something very unusual here. If at this point we have 100% of the normal carriers in the superfluid at zero temperature, then at this point here I have 1%, and 99% are somewhere else. And then the third thing is just comparison of the temperature scales. You can see that this stiffness and TC are about the same. Now, to calibrate you, if you look at niobium, then they are different by a factor of 1,000. So the stiffness in niobium is 1,000 times higher, and that's why you have a very narrow fluctuation region. Here, that fluctuation region is of the order of TC. So that means that you'll have fluctuations at 0.1 Kelvin, and you see them at 3 times TC. And that means that any mean field theory will fail. Okay, so what we can do, one more thing, which is to pick up this point here, which is TC, and this point here, which is rho S zero, and then plot one against another. These are measured quantities, directly measured quantities, and this is the plot, and the error bars are smaller than the size of the markers that I'm showing. So it's a very accurate scaling law. If you look at it from a mile away, then you could say it's a straight line. If you zoom a little bit, then this straight line actually fits up to about here, but it has an offset. It doesn't go through origin. It has offset about 7 Kelvin. And then when you come really close to the edge, which presumably is a quantum critical point, it actually changes the dependence to be something like square root. Okay, so that's what this says, and a comparison with theory. So there are no assumptions here. There are assumptions here. There is two orders of magnitude discrepancy and qualitative disagreement. So that would be my conclusion. My conclusion of this part is that superconducting state in cuprates is really unusual. I'm avoiding the terms unconventional because that in the community means something like P wave or D wave, but it's still BCS. So this would be like a first case where it really looks like non-BCS. To again be vague now, you should differentiate my experimental data from, you know, my blubbering. So I would say that generically in BCS, your TC is determined by dynamics of phonons, which gives you some average frequency, and of electrons, which gives you density of state, and the electron-phonon coupling. What we see here is TC being controlled just by kinematics, just by the density of the superfluid, and that's not BCS-like to me. Now, since theoretically it has been known, I think from work of Gorkov 50 years back and others, is that your Fermi liquid actually is unstable to BCS superconductivity. So I'm reading this backwards, rightly or wrongly, that if your superconducting state is not BCS, then probably your normal state is not going to feed a Fermi liquid. There must be something strange in the normal state. And that's what I'm going to look for. And again, I want to underline, I'm looking for something that is universal, so it will be everywhere in the phase diagram, not just at one point or some narrow region. And there is one thing that we actually identified, and that is this transfers voltage. So if you make a bar of LSCO film like this, so blue is superconducting bar, you have a whole bar, so there is current flowing from 1 to 2, and then we can measure longitudinal resistivity 3 to 5, 5 to 7, or transfers like this. What I'm showing here in red, so let's first look at the blue. Blue is the longitudinal resistivity, underdoped, optimally doped, overdoped, and then red is transfers resistivity, which kind of shows that. I want to point to emphasize that there is no magnetic field here. So this could look like anomalous Hall effect, and you could think of other exotic explanations related to berry curvature, Chern number, etc.
Longitudinal means along the length.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Transverse means
Hall.
3, 4, 5, 6, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Okay. So this is intrinsic effect. It's substantial. This can be like 20% of that. And it's very robust and reproducible. So we have seen it several thousand devices without a single exception. It's always there. So what it is? Okay, I think what it is simply your sample is orthorhombic and not tetragonal. And there is a little bit of group theory here. If you have a tetragonal sample, then these two diagonal elements will be the same, and then every vector is eigenvector, and the matrix will look the same no matter how you rotate the axis. If it is orthorhombic though, so rho A is different from rho B, that is only true for four directions when you hit the principal axis. But as long as you are off the principal axis, since you have, then that's not eigenvector anymore, then you will get off-diagonal matrix elements. And since you know that that has to be zero each time you hit the principal axis, there must be four nodes. And if you just do the transformation, then it actually works like this. So your longitudinal will oscillate as a function of phi, as cosine 2 phi, and so will transfers. They have the same period, four nodes. They are offset by 45. And the big difference is that your longitudinal one oscillates around the average value. So this could be small, you know, this could be 1% of that. But this one oscillates around zero, so it's like Wheatstone bridge. So it's a 100 times more sensitive probe for orthorhombicity. And so far, so good. If you have material that's orthorhombic, you must see this if you do this angle dependence. So this is what we have done. So we made a very simple device that has, instead of one of these, it had 36 of these. So there are 72 longitudinal measurements and 108 transverse voltage measurements on one film. And this is the transverse plotted as a function of angle, and you see cosine 2 phi. This is at room temperature. This is at TC, the same thing. There is big difference in the magnitude. We don't see anything in the longitudinal, or rather you see some kind of random noise, and I'll come to that in a minute. So, okay. The reason is that if you are looking for small orthorhombicity, you should do two things. First thing is look at probe that probes off-diagonal matrix elements. That means cross-polarized Raman or circular dichroism in terahertz. And that these are good probes. The probes that probe diagonal elements are bad. That would be, for example, ARPES, because you're not going to see 1% distortion on the Fermi surface. They just don't have that accuracy, or optics for that matter. So in order to, well, you see, it's devil is in the number. If this is 1%, but your random variation device to device are 3%, you're not going to see that. On the other hand, if this is 20%, then you're going to see it. So we checked the sample that has a bigger effect, which is on underdoped side, and in that case, you can see these oscillations actually also in the longitudinal. like shown here. And the blue dots are raw measured data, and the black diamonds are measured data for the longitudinal. The red one is the fit to the transfers. The red dashed here is not fit to the longitudinal. It's the same fit here, just translated here, shifted 45. And you see that it fits. So that's the explanation. The simple explanation for our effect, there is nothing exotic like Berry phase or Chern numbers or whatever. It's just orthorhombicity, right? Well, and it's present everywhere in the phase diagram at all temperatures, up to the room temperatures, with some dependence. This is a polar plot that shows you that it breaks C4 symmetry, of course, C plus, minus, plus, minus. But what is bizarre and what is not trivial is that our samples are actually strictly tetragonal. And they are tetragonal everywhere in the phase diagram, even here, because our films, okay, so lanthanum strontium cuprate does something like this, which means that over here it should be tetragonal, but then in some region here it actually has tetragonal to orthorhombic phase transition. But my films are very thin and they are epitaxially anchored to a 1 millimeter thick tetragonal substrate. They are strictly tetragonal everywhere by epitaxial constraint. And we have verified that by high resolution X-ray diffraction. So the other thing that you can see is that the director of this nematicity is actually not aligned with the crystal axis. It varies with doping, and in some cases it even varies as a function of temperature. Like at optimum doping, you see that the easy direction is along the nodal direction, but when you come to the region of superconducting fluctuation, it's actually along the copper-oxygen bond. So this is purely electronic effect. It doesn't come from coupling to the lattice. It comes from the electronic system. And okay, I will just flash this. This shows you the systematic doping dependence of the transfer amplitude, and this is of the phase of the orientation. So that then is my conclusion, that actually normal state is also very unusual everywhere in the phase diagram. It behaves like electronic pneumatic, which is not a Fermi liquid, it's a liquid crystal. And then this is then my grand conclusion. I will not have time to talk about insulator, but just say one sentence that the insulating state here is also very unusual. It actually consists of clusters of charge that are formed of local pairs. So it's like SYK. Right? And so what are then the big questions? Universality for other cuprates, we don't know. That has to be tested. We also want to look at iron-based superconductors. And if we pass all these tests, okay, then we may have some hint where to look for more. Thank you.
Start back there.
How strong is the orthorhombicity coming from the overdope side at the foot of the dome where you were measuring the superfluid density?
Well, this is the longitudinal, and this is the amplitude of the transfer. So you actually, the other parameter should be the ratio, but you see that it actually drops, follows kind of straight line more or less. So the amplitude actually drops when you go towards the overdope side. In the color plot here, I don't know whether you can see, there is a gray area here, which means we are within the noise, so we don't know what's happening there, superconducting dome, but there is also something like a gray triangle here, which ends about 100 Kelvin. So that means that at 0.26, which is the edge of the dome, we can see this to about 100 Kelvin. And then about 100 Kelvin, we are in our noise floor. And that's a fraction of a percent. So it's very small here, But at the underdoped side, when you're, in particular, when you're close to TC, it can be 20% effect. So it's a substantial effect.
You showed data for penetration depth and superfluid density down to what, about 5 Kelvin?
That's the lowest one that I have shown. We have, samples which are non-superconducting. It's a technical issue.
On the other
issue.
Data, how far down do you go below, say, 5?
I have a sample that is 1 Kelvin. We can measure down to 0.3. But then the question is how you extrapolate to 0. So we stopped at 5 because at that point I still have a pretty sharp transition, and my lambda as a function of temperature is horizontal enough that I can extrapolate to 0. Once you get to below a few Kelvin, then it becomes fishy. You would need Dilfridge or something like that to really know what's the 0.
So
there may be other ways to, we will in future study that quantum critical point by the different, in the different ways where we can really tweak continuous. We can use the electrolyte gating, and then we can move one and the same sample in really small steps.
So you refer to this as a spontaneous breaking of C4, so presumably it's an electronic monoclinic phase?
No, it's orthorhombic.
Okay, but it's, sure, but we can maybe come back to that, but do you see any evidence of, you know, you cool the sample, you make multiple crystals and they break the symmetry spontaneously in different ways?
Okay, so the way these data are measured is that we have 108 of these, so we cannot, and multiply by 2, so we cannot wire bond them all at the same time, which means that we wire bond like 3 or 4 of these and measure down to, you know, 3 Kelvin, and then back up, and then we break these bonds, we make other bonds. So to get one of these curves, we are cycling one and the same sample 20 times to room temperature and back. And that tells you that this orientation, the orientation of the director cannot be temperature dependent. Otherwise, we would not have seen the same day. So it is actually fixed. I can actually show the data. I have some additional stuff here. So that, for example, answered, okay, so we have seen this effect first in 2006. We published it in 2017, so 11 years. This 11 years was filtering out any possible experimental artifact until the point that I can bet my life on it. And so what you see here are 3 different samples of the same, exact same doping. And you're looking at AFM. So it shows that there are steps on the film. These steps come from the miscut of the substrate. You can see that this miscut is very different in all these samples in terms of distance and orientation. Nevertheless, they have the same amplitude, the same phase. So it is intrinsic property of the Fermi surface or something like that. So you have fixed doping. 5 different samples will reproduce.
I think thought, or at least a related question to what Doug asked, was not how low TC goes, but if you start with a sample, I don't know, with TC of 10 Kelvin, how low in temperature can you measure the superfluid density, and how low does, in particular, the T-linear?
We measure to 0.3.
To 0.3.
0.3 is actually in
and,
that.
And it's still T-linear down to that. Is that?
In this plot here, the data are separated into 2 groups. So this is just a zoom in of that one here. So data for these guys up to this dense point here are largely measured just down to 3 Kelvin. because that's enough. Your lambda is horizontal there. The corner here, these are 15 samples with lowest TCs from 7 to 5 or whatever. They are all measured to 0.3. And that's what you see. So, you know, that really is very small temperature range missing.
These are beautiful data. Question regarding the superfluid density. So on the overdose side, you have two regimes, if I understand correctly, one low TC regime and one higher TC regime, right? I wonder if you see, presumably you have similarly beautiful data on the underdoped side, and I wonder if you see something similar on the underdoped side, deviations from the Uemura scaling.
I think this is a profound question that hits right to the jugular. The data like this exist in the literature from a group of Walter Hardy on the underdoped side. It's a different material, different technique, different measurement technique, exactly same curve. It's YBCO, underdoped side. The only difference is that their offset is 4 Kelvin, mine is 7. But it has linear with an offset and then square root close to the quantum critical point. You don't have doping here. I want to point out that this region here is tiny. In our case, it's like between 0.25 and 0.26. So it's really tiny region next to the edge. And in their case, it's even smaller. So it's very tiny region where it goes like that. Looks like a 2D quantum critical fluctuation.
Hi. Regarding your last part, when you talk about the direction, or the director of the nematics, I would expect that if you start making thicker and thicker films, eventually it's going to start locking with the lattice because you're going to have more room to relax the lattice. Is this something doable? Or maybe you already did?
Yep. Answer is yes. Okay, so what I want to show, maybe this one here. So what we have done here is we have went step further, which is to actually deliberately grow films on an orthorhombic substrate. We can enforce epitaxy to be tetragonal or orthorhombic. And then you see that actually director changed. So in this case, this is doping should be indicated. Underdoped but close to optimum. On tetragonal one, the director would be something like 20 degrees off the axis. On the orthorhombic one, it rotates and pins to the crystal axis. But the amplitude, interestingly, is pretty much the same. So this is large orthorhombic distortion. It's about 1% orthorhombic distortion. All it does is to rotate the director. We also have comparison between our films and then single crystals. And the difference in the single crystals, for example, Ando's work, X.02.04, amplitude is the same. The orientation is different. Theirs is pinned to the crystal axis and ours not.
Yeah, probably a very naive question. Back to TC scales linearly with superfluid stiffness. You are saying that your films are very clean, so this is not disorder effect. But right. Is there any way to add disorder in a controllable way and see how the slope changes?
This would illustrate that. So what we have done here, we are comparing two films. They have different doping levels, but same TC. So this one is optimally doped, but we have spoiled it with zinc. So it reduced TC a little bit. It should have been about 41, 42, it's maybe 38. Then we take an overdoped film that has exact same TC. So they start from the same point. And you see that the clean one is linear and the dirty one is parabolic. below 25 Kelvin or even 30, you can see that it deviates. Now the point is that this has 0.005 zinc, so it's 1 out of 200 copper atoms. So you add your pepper tiny amount of unitary scatterer, it completely changes the temperature dependence. You cannot miss that. You mean at close to TC here, right? This is low temperature. So this guy is almost linear. This guy is very clearly parabolic. So impurities have dramatic effect. They affect your linear temperature dependence. That also has been seen and known forever for the underdoped side. Again, Walter Hardy's group, they would actually fit this and extract some temperature T double star where it changes from linear to parabolic, and the interpretation was that you have V-shaped gap that should be linear, but if you have a little bit of impurities, then you will have some rounding, so this temperature would be characteristic temperature for your crossover. And what you see here without any theory, that when my sample has impurities, I know it right away.
Yeah, Doug, you had a comment.
Comment on this. So zinc is a unitary scatter.
Yes, yes.
What if your impurities in your system are more Born-like, because your system is much better made, but it has some weak scattering off the plane, which is then more Born-like or perhaps more forward-like?
These are a little bit different things, right?
The results.
If you add a small amount of weak scatterers, then I would assume that the effect would be weak. But so I think it could still survive and look linear. But the operative word is small. If you put enough weak scatter, bone scatterers, to reduce superfluid carrier density by two orders of magnitude, then the sample would just be insulating. It would not be even metallic. Forward scattering is a little more subtle. That would require longer.
Okay. And so. Comrade, and then David, and then Gabby. Yeah, go on, Comrade.
Comrade. Shall.
Oh, sorry.
Back again to the D-wave, dirty D-wave picture. You see, you have seen probably this paper by David Brun, who tries this recent PRB paper about penetration depth, tries to look at your data with D-wave
DCs. Yeah.
But you see, from thermal conductivity on thallium, we know that, of course, if you measure kappa over T, it has been done by many groups, it's very easy to measure, it doesn't need the high, accuracy you are looking for. We know that half of the residual fluid density is normal carriers. You see, we don't expect in the overdoped regime to find the superfluid density equal to the normal state, because we know because of pair breaking, and it works. You know, for thermal conductivity, D-wave, dirty D-wave works. The whole question is, how can you exclude really that what you see is beyond dirty D-wave? Since, your samples can be very clean, but since the gap is going to zero, at some point you are going to hit the dirty limit.
Okay. So this is a short list of 10 different arguments that rule out that picture. Violation of the Ferro-Glover-Tinkham rule. The Holmes law would follow from dirty picture because that's like straightforward consequence of FGT rule. For a dirty D-wave superconductor, this would be the prediction. This is the experiment. What else? This is another way. Okay, this is yet another one. This is not now my data. These are data from, Nigel Hussey's group. This is thallium 2201. and the sample has TC reduced by a factor of 10. So it is very heavily overdoped. From USR on same or similar sample, these two papers, the superfluid carry densities are a couple of percent, 1% of the total. And you see these oscillations, 200 of these oscillations. This is ultra clean. We have more. But I think this one kills dirty this TV picture. Dirty BCS, it doesn't mean that there is no scattering, no disorder, but there is no quantitative version of Abrikosov, Gorkov, Scalapino, Hirschfeld, etc. theory that actually can go all the way to 1%, 99% superfluid carry density loss within BCS.
So my question is about the pneumatic part again. So in bulk single crystals, you know, there's neutron diffraction showing some very subtle monoclinic distortions coming from small deformations of the oxygen octahedron. And I think the monoclinicity in principle can give you these off-diagonal resistivity elements. So my question is how tetragonal can you characterize your crystal or your films to be?
Yeah, this is deep and subtle question, which I think affects the whole field of electronic pneumaticity. I would say, first of all, I think that there are two types of electronic pneumaticity. One, which is not new, it's something I studied 45 years ago, which is linear fibronic coupling, like Jan-Teller effect, Pyrrhus transition, charge density waves, orbital ordering. All of this comes from linear coupling of the electrons to the lattice, which comes from the degeneracy in the electronic system, which you lift in the first order perturbation theory, and then one empty one goes up, the occupied goes down, and you get stabilization energy. That comes from ionic displacement coupling, and therefore you can see it by neutrons, you can see it in X-rays as atomic displacement. And more important, there is a relation between the magnitude of displacement and the perturbation of the electronic energy. For Pyrrhus, it goes something like Q square ln Q, which means that if you reduce your Q by a factor of 10, your delta A will be go down by a factor of 1,000. And that means that if I have two samples, one of which has 1% distortion, and the other that has 0.001% distortion, there should be 9 orders of magnitude difference. And what I have shown is that in single crystals and Genda-Gu that we measured, the amplitude of this pneumaticity is about the same as in the film that has at least, you know, 100 times less orthorhombic distortion. We cannot say it's zero, but it's tiny. Okay.
So, Gabby, quick question.
Yeah, I mean, can you comment in general why there's no hint of costly Stawless transition in your setup?
Not in my setup. There are no hints of Kosterlitz-Tauli transition in superconductors, which is known to Kosterlitz and to Tauli, except at high frequencies. A classical paper, Beasley, Orlando, Mui, 79, 89, the interaction between vortices and anti-vortexes goes from being logarithmic at short distances to actually it's not logarithmic once you exceed the penetration depth. But what that means is that you have to measure a sample that is smaller than the pearl penetration depth, and no one does that. But then there is a complementary theory from Kogan, who said actually if once you have it small, then the edge effects kill the transition. So the only way to see it is to go to frequency high enough where the vortices just wiggle like this, and then lo and behold, we see. But technically in the field, people call this dynamic BKT. So static, you know, low frequency, you shouldn't see anything in charged superfluid. In neutral superfluid, sure, yes, you see that.
Okay, let's thank you all for being here.